a few weeks ago, I was flying Singapore Airlines, and I was talking to the crew about the situation, whether they were worried, what the airline was doing, and they said that we feel pretty confident about this. We managed SARS pretty well, so they felt like they kind of practiced and they knew what was coming. But just a few days later, the airline revealed massive cuts to their routes. And I think this is something we're seeing all across the industry. And airlines are not prepared for this. They had no idea the scale that this would reach. And we still don't really know how big the scale will be and how long it will last. So it's a scary time for airlines in many ways, and especially for the employees, not really knowing, now that many of them are being sent on involuntary leave, not knowing when or if they'll get to come back to their jobs.
Okay, I would see many layoffs there. Atafe, let me start with you here. What Dan Goss said there, there are a whole range of industries that have been affected because of this COVID-19, suffering the impact that has been so widespread. Of course, not to mention the devastating loss of lives because of it. Do you think that there's finally a light at the end of the tunnel that we're seeing right now, especially with the announcement of the vaccine? And how long will it take for things to return back to normal, you think?
Well, a vaccine is definitely a good news, but we have to understand that not every country has started the vaccination, and it will take months, perhaps a year, for everyone across the globe get vaccinated. And a lot of experts say that 2021, the winter of 2021, is going to be the time when things are finally going to move toward becoming normal. But I believe that we cannot call that normal. The life that we knew before this pandemic is over, and things have changed. There's going to be a new normal after this pandemic.
Okay, Mahan, it seems that the vaccines that are being introduced are from at least two of the big pharmaceutical companies. What are the names here? Pfizer and AstraZeneca. We're all too familiar with pharmaceutical companies. Of course, their main intention to cure people, but what's behind their intention? Do you think that the rollout of the vaccine is just another big money-making opportunity for these pharmaceuticals?
Yes, but that would be the obvious answer. That's what pharmaceutical companies do all the time. They want to make money, and no one can begrudge them for that. The same arguments are made during the AIDS issue all those years ago, that they're trying to make money at the expense of people and other diseases and pandemics. I think the real issue here is the disparity in the people getting the vaccine, the rich-poor divide, or more specifically this time, the north-south divide. So you see the Western countries, led by the UK, have rushed into getting the vaccine done. The EU started today, the Americans a few days ago. They're going to have people vaccinated. Whereas in other countries in the world, vaccination is slow to start.
All right, let's now take a look at another huge story that rocked the year 2020, namely the economic and political issues affecting the U.S. From trade wars with China to racial inequality, they all had a massive impact on the U.S. economy and ultimately on Donald Trump.
As the world's largest economy, many would have speculated that 2020 would have been a good year for the US. After all, President Donald Trump has taken reasonable steps to build up the American economy from the inside out. Yet 2020 brought with it multiple events that would change the ideas of many. Naturally, the coronavirus played a huge part in the year, with millions of Americans infected by the virus. Having the highest death rate in the world also didn't help. And of course, the subsequent impact on the US economy, with furlough schemes and payouts all failing to truly hit the mark. Following this was a series of stock market crashes, oil price crashes, and various collapses in trade, all linked to the various events. Donald Trump also lost his ties with China following a bitter trade war, and yet, in spite of numerous efforts to plaster the cracks over, China and the US have become trade rivals, sparking off a host of bitter words by Trump towards China, including calling COVID-19 the Chinese virus. Trump's racist views soon became reflected at home. Following the brutal murder of George Floyd by police officers, Trump failed to take assertive action by condemning the act, sparking off the Black Lives Matter movement, which soon spread to a global phenomenon. It seems that Trump's failure to effectively deal with the COVID-19 crisis, as well as his poor handling of the BLM movement, it ultimately cost him his job as Joe Biden swept to a landslide victory in the presidentials, something that Trump still finds a bitter pill to swallow.
Earlier in the year, we were joined by Professor Robert Elliott from the University of Birmingham, and he spoke about the ongoing trade war between China and the U.S. Let's remind ourselves of just what he said.
There's very little willingness on the part of the U.S. to punish China at this stage due to concerns about the economic impact that any breakdown in relations would have on the, you know, the global economy is already struggling due to the pandemic. So, you know, where are we? We're in election year. Trump has still a lot to gain from being tough on China. But of course, with an economy in free fall, it's going to be very difficult. He's got a very difficult balancing act to perform at the moment.
Not much of an act anymore for him. I think he's going to be outgoing. Okay, let me start with you, Mahan. Sure. The big news this year was not only the economic impact of the virus, but also the failure of Donald Trump to not only contain it, but also seems like to win a second term in office. Do you think that Joe Biden can bring something new to the table, especially when it comes to China? Is it going to be a different approach than what Donald Trump had?
Well, he'll definitely have a softer tone. But however, in terms of the actual policies and the general U.S. approach to China, I don't think so. Because the policies are obviously set by the institutions. And the key U.S. institutions, you know, the Pentagon, the CIA, the State Department, in addition to the whole kind of, you know, American apparatus, they're very Sinophobic right now for a good reason. China is catching up. Mm-hmm. Not only catching up, but by 2028, it's going to supersede the U.S. as the world's leading economy.
I see you kept up with the news. That just came out.
Yeah, absolutely.
Good. Okay, out of it to you. The Black Lives Matter movement, that was another big story, obviously, for this past year. Economic inequality, amongst other things, were highlighted by them. What legacy will Trump have left as a president that perhaps is negative, that many say led to the division of the U.S., that maybe Joe Biden needs to then pick up the pieces?
Well, definitely Trump divided America. That's his legacy. And I think for Biden, whatever he wants to do when he becomes the president, first things first, he has to bridge the gap between white Americans and not white Americans. He has to unite the United States once again.
Very well. Now, Europe will be also seeing a major economic shift, namely in the shape of Brexit. Let's take a look at the latest development there and look back at a year of extensions and frustrations for the Brexit negotiating teams.
In 2016, Britain went to the polls and voted to leave the European Union. The term Brexit was soon dubbed and became major news for the next 4 years. Following the vote, negotiations began to take place between the UK and the EU as to just how Britain would leave the bloc, with many people in the UK pushing for a so-called no-deal Brexit, believing that Britain did not need to deal with the EU and were quite capable of going it alone. However, the reality of a no-deal soon set in, with businesses realising that without the EU trade benefits, things would get a lot tougher in Britain. Many multinational corporations, including major banks and European medicines agencies, downsized or left the UK altogether following the vote, putting thousands of jobs at risk and giving a taste of things to come. With the majority of Britain's food coming from the EU, supermarket shelves began to empty, prices began to increase, and concerns about the free movement of people and access to labour all played a part in a post-Brexit trauma. Recently, talks stalled and failed on multiple occasions as the end of the transition period came near, with Britain attempting to stand firm against the EU on fishing rights, fair competition and trade rules, with many EU figures vying to make an example of the UK to others. Yet it seems, during extra time of play, the EU and Britain finally settled on a deal, as announced on Christmas Eve by Boris Johnson and Ursula von der Leyen. However, the terms and conditions are still very shady, with the north of Ireland essentially being handed to the Republic of Ireland on a plate, hardliner Brexiteers reeling at Johnson, and indications suggesting that even the deal announced will have a huge negative impact on the British GDP. It seems that Brexit only ever spelt a lose-lose situation for Britain, who now find themselves alone and begging for business.
We'll be right back. One of the most contentious issues surrounding Brexit was the hard border on the island of Ireland. Now, when we covered Brexit earlier this year, we spoke to former Sinn Féin director of publicity as to what he thought would happen. And it seems that in terms of a deal that was struck, well, some of the things that he did say appears to be right.
Of course, there are consequences for whatever direction the British government goes in and whatever it adopts. The European Union and lots of its foreign ministers strongly suspect that Johnson wants to bail out without a deal. And I have explained to your viewers the possible consequences of this in the north if the British government imposes a hard border at the end. Because a hard border, of course, means customs posts being set up, then policemen to protect them, and then soldiers to protect the policemen. And that would be a return of the military presence in the north of Ireland. That would be a recipe for disaster.
Okay. Mahan, to you. The north of Ireland, long been a topic of debate, obviously, in the UK.
Yeah.
Brexit, it has come and a deal has been set. But it ignited the Republican movement in Ireland, with many feeling that United Ireland is actually closer than ever because
yes.
of this Brexit. I mean, what are your thoughts on this?
I think it's within touching distance. Brexit has been a key driver, obviously. And now this post-Brexit trade deal is exacerbating the situation. But there's always been a groundswell for Irish unity. And for the first time ever, you can see connectivity between people in the Republic of Ireland, the political class, I mean, and the Republican movement in the north. They're kind of coming together, not seamlessly. Obviously, there's a lot of division between them. And for the first time in a couple of generations, the unionist movement in the north of Ireland is in real retreat. These are the pro-British people. And they've obviously dominated political life in Northern Ireland for time immemorial. Mm-hmm. But their grip is loosening. The UK is weaker as a result of Brexit. I mean, the real big issue here is Scottish independence, and that's going to happen very soon.
Well, the Brits are in trouble because the COVID-19, obviously, Atifa, has affected their economy so badly. Then we saw Brexit and what it did. We'll have to wait and see, obviously, post-Brexit, how it's going to affect the UK. And recently, we just saw the news that the 3,000 trucks that were unable to travel, the aerial shots of that was quite striking. Do you think that Brexit is going to bring more economic hardships for the UK?
Absolutely. The UK has to find new market and investors outside the European Union. Their traditional partners in the EU are not going to be as helpful as they used to be in 2021. The EU wants to make an example of the UK. They want to show the other members of the bloc that it's not going to be a good idea to leave the bloc and stand on your own. So I believe that there's going to be a lot of economic hardship because of this pandemic. The UK cannot make the connection it wants, and so it's going to pressure its citizens. There's going to be more austerities and more economic hardship in the future.
Okay, it's clear that some challenging times lie ahead for the UK, but let's now take a look back at our final topic of this show, the impact of sanctions.
In spite of the world dealing with the terrible effects of the COVID-19 virus, it seems that the year also saw an opportunity for some nations to abuse their power, imposing sanctions on other nations during the global pandemic. The Islamic Republic of Iran, for example, has been placed under sanctions by the US president following his withdrawal from the JCPOA upon taking office. With Iran seeing one of the worst initial rates of infection during the birth of the pandemic, sanctions meant that accessing vital medical supplies to treat patients and protect frontline workers became a challenge to deal with on top of the virus. Iran labelled the sanctions as economic terrorism. However, it also proved that the maximum pressure policy on Iran failed to work as Iran pushed on through to become self-sufficient. Further afield, the US also placed sanctions on the likes of Yemen and Syria, with the former entering what the United Nations called a humanitarian disaster, as famine, drought, and lack of medical supplies meant that innocent victims were dying from a preventable cause, as well as being pounded by US-supplied weapons from the Saudi regime to the north. With Donald Trump as the key author of the sanctions facing a humiliating exit from the White House, what now remains to be seen is whether incoming Joe Biden may take a different view on sanctions and reverse the cruel acts committed by his predecessor.
Earlier in the year, we spoke to Kern Alexander, professor of law, finance, and banking regulations from the University of Zurich in Switzerland. Let's remind ourselves as to what he said about sanctions.
Well, sanctions have historically been used by countries as instruments of foreign policy. And in countries, the effectiveness of sanctions depends really on the extent and influence of a country's economy. So the United States, of course, comes in for a lot of criticism for its use of economic sanctions because the U.S. economy is large and many countries want to trade with the U.S. But the downside of that is that when the U.S. wants to try to get its way in foreign policy, it will restrict access to its economy with its trade relations with other countries. And so and that has a negative impact on diplomacy, and it has a negative impact also on certain groups in foreign countries.
Okay, let me turn to you first, Atifet. Economic sanctions, obviously, it has been described by some. I'm looking at Iran's foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, who called it economic terrorism. So, and obviously, Iran being a country that has suffered so much from these sanctions, they, as our guest even alluded to there, said it, ability for various countries to gain access to vital resources, it has restricted that, and medicine, humanitarian supplies or goods in general is one of the areas that has been restricted. Do you think that the U.S. has used sanctions to actually exert pressure on these countries?
Definitely. As it was mentioned on our interview, the United States always used this strategy to pressure certain countries, not just the U.S. Some of its Western allies used the same strategy. We saw examples in Iraq and Libya when these countries were under heavy sanctions by U.S. and some other countries like France and U.K. And finally, what happened was that these countries were plunged into war and chaos. So that could be amount to economic terrorism, as Dr. Zarif said.
Yes, and Mahan, Iran has been a victim of that. And Trump obviously exercised what we have heard so much throughout his tenure, and that's the maximum pressure policy. At the same time, Iran has said that we've defeated that. Of course, it's been a hard road these past 4 years. Now, with Biden news swirling that he may come back to the JCPOA, do you think that he's going to at least do what Iran has said for them will be a prerequisite, and that's a complete return and a complete lifting of the sanctions?
I think the important thing here, as the leadership here in Iran set out, our priority, our focus shouldn't be just to wait for the sanctions to be lifted. We don't know about the motivation of either side. The priority here is to defeat the sanctions, more self-reliance, strengthen the economy. I personally believe that sanctions are not the root cause of our economic problems. There are a whole host of other issues that we can address locally.
Thanks again to both Mahan and to you, Atifet, for your valuable contributions throughout throughout this year. We obviously look forward to having you back next year, 2021, and see what you have to say in terms of the things that you share with us. Again, thanks for all of that. Well, that's all the time we have for this end-of-the-year special on Economic Divide. And as we enter the year 2021, we look forward to bringing more of the stories that matter to you. On behalf of the whole team here on Economic Divide, Happy New Year. Stay safe.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech from IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Sayyid Mohsen Kharrazi. Please stay tuned.
دیگه از آیاتی که در این زمینه هست این آیه مبارک است که در سوره شعرا
From ayah 224 of Surah Shu'ara to the end of this surah we read, As for the poets, only the perverse follow them. Have you not regarded that they rove in every valley, and that they say what they do not do? Barring those who have faith and do righteous deeds, and remember Allah greatly, and aid each other after they have been wronged. And the wrongdoers will soon know at what goal they will end up. In this verse of the Holy Quran, Allah is distinguishing between righteous people and the corrupt poets. The exception, as explained in these verses, is those poets who have faith in Allah and remember Allah frequently. In other words, the best criterion to make distinction between good and evil in every field, even poetry, is belief in Allah and doing good deeds. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Sayyid Mohsen Kharrazi. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.com/en, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Limelight.
Georgia claimed that thousands of voters submitted postal change of address forms, but the U.S. Postal Service said they did not. In addition, Georgia allegedly violated the NVRA by employing an unlicensed contractor who used an incorrect list, says Marjorie Conrader in an article published under the heading, U.S. Civil Rights Groups Fight Back Against Georgia's Voter Purges. Stay tuned, please. The importance of January 5th Senate runoff elections in Georgia cannot be overestimated. They will determine which party controls the Senate, with vast ramifications for economic policy, climate change, workers' rights, immigrants' rights, judicial nominees, and much more. The purging of nearly 200,000 registered voters from the voting rolls in Georgia could spell the difference between a Republican or a Democratic majority in the Senate. In October 2019, Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger purged 313,243 people from the voter rolls, claiming they had moved from their registration residence, which is a ground for removal under the National Voter Registration Act, NVRA. But five top expert firms hired by the PLAST Investigative Fund, PIF, determined that 198,351 of those Georgia voters had not moved at all and were therefore illegally purged from the rolls. Georgia claimed that thousands of voters submitted postal change of address forms, but the U.S. Postal Service said they did not. In addition, Georgia allegedly violated the NVRA by employing an unlicensed contractor who used an incorrect list. The PIF experts performed a name-by-name analysis of the addresses using advanced address list hygiene. John Lenser, an address hygiene consultant and CEO of American Fifth Act, testified that this is the industry standard for residential address verification. The experts called on more than 240 data sources. They found a 63.3% error rate. That doesn't even include tens of thousands of other voters purged for moving within their neighborhoods or apartment buildings, which constitutes a violation of the NVRA. Georgia's officials have been exposed using a horrendously inaccurate list of voters whom they claim had filled out postal change of address forms. Investigative reporter Greg Palas told reporters. The postal service itself says they did not fill them out. They did not move. Yet, the postal hacks that run Georgia's elections have chosen this rotten trick to stop tens of thousands of citizens from voting. The cancellations primarily impact young voters, low-income voters, and people of color. In a prior case, Georgia's Secretary of State admitted that voters could be restored to the polls within 24 to 48 hours if necessary. Why, then, does Raffensperger refuse to reinstate those voters? It is a cold, racially poisonous game, brazenly backed by the Republican National Committee lawyers desperate to bend the upcoming Senate runoff, Palas said. The voter registrations were canceled because the Secretary of State alleged they had filed a change of address form with the National Change of Address NCOA registry. Election officials had received returned mail, and Georgia law, in effect at the time of the cancellations, allowed removal if, after 3 years of no contact, the voter did not return a confirmation postcard and then did not vote in the next two general elections. This is known as use it or lose it. Four civil rights organizations, including Black Voter Matter and Rainbow PUSH Coalition, filed a lawsuit in U.S. District Court for Northern District of Georgia on December 2nd. The suit was based on the expert reporting of PIF and the official report of ACLU of Georgia that was published on September 1st, 2020. Those experts determined that 199,908 voters can still receive mail at their address of registration, so it is not likely they have moved. Plaintiffs are asking that the nearly 200,000 names allegedly wrongfully removed from the voter rolls be restored in time for the critical runoff election on January 5th. In the alternative, they seek the appointment of a special master, an expert who would review the work of the PIF experts and the Secretary of State's list maintenance experts to decide which voters were wrongfully removed from the rolls and reinstate them. The NVRA, which Congress enacted in 1993, declares that voting is a fundamental right. It requires that federal, state, and local governments promote the exercise of the right to vote. And it says, discriminatory and unfair registration laws and procedures can have a direct and damaging effect on voter participation in elections for federal office and disproportionately harm voter participation by various groups, including racial minorities. Georgia's use it or lose it rule violates the Equal Protection Clause of 14th Amendment. The lawsuit claims because it creates incorrect distinctions, thereby disenfranchising infrequent voters. On December 16, 2020, the district court judge denied the plaintiff's request for an injunction for noncompliance with NVRA's 90-day notice requirement, but the judge said there were discrepancies and told the parties to sit down and try to settle the case. On December 28, 2020, the plaintiffs filed a motion for reconsideration and a request to add the Palas Investigative Fund as a plaintiff in the case. A letter the plaintiff's attorney sent to Raffensperger on September 22nd on behalf of PIF would then satisfy the 90-day notice period, which expired on December 23rd, 2020. The plaintiffs are also asking the judge to order the Secretary of State to count the provisional ballots of voters who tried to vote but whose registrations were canceled for moving when they didn't move, as documented by the plaintiff's experts. The voting rights groups have not joined together to develop a proactive strategy to expand voting rights given the amount of defense they had to play. Jean Mirer, activist from New York, said she thinks it is more important than ever for progressive groups to work in coalition to combat the Republican efforts in 2021 and 2022 to shut the doors to easing access to voting that COVID-19 opened. Expect an onslaught of moves to constrict access to the ballot, she said. Meanwhile, Mirer's legal team will continue the struggle to reinstate the purged Georgia voters to the rolls in time for the Senate runoff elections. Biden beat Trump in Georgia by 12,000 votes. The purged voters could decide who wins on January 5th.
Start.
Movement.
Speak.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station.
I am a Muslim. Islamite. Islamite. Allah my Lord. Allah my Lord. His word Quran. His word Quran. Muhammad Prophet. Muhammad Prophet. Praise be upon. Praise be upon. I am Muslim for all.
By the first verse of the Holy Quran,
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Allah will bless you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Protect you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Help you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
So ask His blessings.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
His protection.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
His help.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, brothers and sisters, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, other life forms. Welcome to today's episode of Youth Station. I am your host, Zainab, and in the studio with me, I have my co-host,
Mehdi, and I'm wondering, are other life forms actually sat there and listening to the radio or not?
I think they definitely would, because we are one of the profound, distinguished specimens of human example. Talking about caring is sharing is loving. Have you ever been in love? Have you ever experienced any kind of love?
The official opinion, which is mine, I'll come up. Generally, there's Eros. The Greeks have defined it for us, and we've just brought it down without question. That's something that's the first one.
Relationship. Romantic love?
Yeah, between two people, right? Philia is... the love that is between siblings, between a mother and a child.
So a platonic love. Platonic love is it's like a brotherly love.
Oh, that's affection.
Or friendly love. And?
Agape. So it's got no boundaries in the sense that sort of unconditional, right? The Greeks have related it to the relationship between the love of God and man, and man and God. God's love towards the man,
his creations, and his creation's and love toward him.
Shuhada. In heaven, many people have got these questions. Oh, who was this? The hul, which is, there's male and female, by the way. So the questions
are... Hul al-Ayn, you mean?
Yeah. So okay. There's male and female. So people say, why is it that it's for men and stuff like that? Yeah. The hul... They complain to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, to the angels, that why are these people not paying attention, right?
To us.
And that's when the angels say, let them be. Let them be. They have lost themselves in something far greater, even in heaven, right? Good. That's love. So once you reach that point that you do not need any motivation, heaven, hell, motivation in the sense that... you want something or you want to stay away from something, which is hell, right? Once you've reached the actual point, then you don't need that, right? That's love, unconditional. You lose everything, right? and of course you gain everything.
You gain everything. Yeah, you lose everything and you gain everything that matters.
Now compare that. You've been given a life. You can use that and achieve the greatest thing that's possible, right? We discussed what that is. And then you end your life for an iPhone. For an iPhone.
First of all, there could be a lot of reasons behind this. That person could be suffering from an underlying mental illness from before.
Well, my bad, actually. That's so true. I remember Sheikh Azhar, I'm going to shout out to him, Sheikh Azhar Nasir, he's actually said that about people
suicide
who commit suicide.
And depression. And so there could be so many reasons, yeah. Right? But I do understand where your question is coming from, that we
failure to ourselves with things that
exactly are so futile and fleeting and insignificant when we were made for so much more. We were made to lose ourselves, lose sleep, lose food, lose everything that we have for the creator of the heaven and earth.
Or even gain everything for him. For example,
exactly.
One of the companions comes to a Ma'asum alayhi salam and he says, I'm in a state that I like poverty more than wealth. I like being ill more than being healthy. He mentions a few things around like these.
Okay.
And he says, he explains the reason why. He's like, because when I'm poor, I remember Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala more than when I'm wealthy. And like the same with health and stuff. And Imam al-Islam says, that's all right, but that's not how we are.
Mm.
We are happy where he has put us. If he's put
beautiful.
Us in the, you know.
So whether Allah wills health for us or sickness, whether he wills wealth or poverty, whether he wills anything for us, if that's where his satisfaction is, that's where I want to be.
Yeah.
And it makes perfect sense. Talking about the love of Allah, okay? I feel that we need to define something before we continue with our discussion, which is that love, just like hate, they're both innate qualities of the human being. We're born with it. We were born with an innate need to love and be loved. Like children, infant children. Mm-hmm. We can say that, oh, it's biological touch, it's biological growth. Love is biological. You know, like an infant child, there are hospitals where people volunteer to hold these babies that were orphaned or they were abandoned or whatever, because that is an essential key element required for the baby's healthy growth, to be held, to feel protected and loved.
Wow. You know, yeah.
Otherwise, the baby will die. You know,
that's literally the case.
That is literally the case, bro, with us. And I feel that some of these loves, I feel that we've misunderstood love and the objective of love.
Yeah, just like you had.
My love for that kitten. I feel that way when I see a mole rat. I feel like that when I see a slithering snake. I feel like that when I see a lot of other creatures, because I'm not saying that, oh, I'm such a wonderful person and I've just reached the highest level of human perfection.
I
feel like, look at this fluffy little thing, so different from me, yet so glorious and beautiful because Allah created it, because Allah felt like it needs to be created. And that's what it provokes all my love and affection and, oh my God, let me die for this cat kind of feeling inside me. I won't literally die for that cat, but you know what I'm trying to say? It makes me feel so fuzzy and warm on the inside because I feel like the same Allah that, you know, he didn't put any time out because it was like kun fayakun, but the same Allah that decided to create me created this kitten. I feel that sense of love towards this living creature.
Yeah, fair enough. But
and I think
why?
That's if how love manifests itself, how it's supposed to manifest. But I'm
no,
saying...
you're not. But my point is, if someone is listening to you right now and they do not believe in God, you've actually said something very controversial, right?
No, even universe. They don't believe in God, but they still believe in existence.
Right, but you
said... If I was important enough for nature, or for, I don't know, the Big Bang Theory, or if I were important enough, look, just nature, you know? If I exist within nature just as this little kitten does, that's beautiful. And I personally am, of course, talking obviously from the perspective of a person whose religion is nothing but love.
Right?
If another person who doesn't believe in my religion and doesn't believe in the love I believe in, they still believe in that single, united, solidarity love of the universe and how precious it is that I exist and am capable of love and that kitten exists or that other person exists, Jack and Henry exist, you know?
Mm-hmm. So you say... I'm a bit confused right now. So
you're always confused, but what is it now?
After confusion is conclusion. Wow, such a smart thing to say. But what I'm saying is that you said that you love the kitten because, you know, the Lord Almighty has made that, whatever it is, a kitten or a snake, whatever it is. Why does this have to go with... what's the correlation over here?
Creation. And Allah's ability to create and His love for His creations. You're not going to tell me Allah doesn't love that kitten. If Allah loves it, why can't I love it?
That's what I'm saying. Like, for example, someone comes up to you and says, listen, why do you love something because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala loves it, which is the best reason to love something. But someone who's asking you this question... you're not going to say you're dumb, right? You're going to say something to them.
Because I love Allah. That's my answer. Full stop.
Right. Remember the question. What's your name?
Zainab.
Go on with the story now.
My other question is...
Go on with the story.
Which question?
What's your name?
Zainab.
Go on with the... Has Zainab salamu alayha.
That's the right. That's exactly what Sayyidah Zainab said. Ma ra'aytu illa jamila. I saw nothing but beauty because Allah willed it. Even though it was a devastating tragedy, because it was in accordance with His will, it was beautiful and I love it. Remember that hadith Qudsi that you mentioned about whoever seeks me will find me, who finds me will know me, and when they know me, they love me, and when they love me, they're going to be ashaqani, they're going to be crazy about me, they're going to lose themselves in me, and then when they ashaqani, ashaqtuhu, I will love them, we will lose each other in each other, and then I will kill them. That's what Allah did with Abu Abdullah.
Alayhi salam. Yeah, that's exactly what happened, you know. But
and Sayyidah Zainab saw that as nothing but beautiful.
So... which I was trying to say originally was this. What you said was right, but I wasn't pointing towards that story. I was pointing towards the story with Imam Ali alayhi salam when Hazrat Zainab salamu alayha was in his lap.
But wow. My story was awesome too.
It was beautiful. Thank actually. You. And that's actually, you know, the hadith that you repeated and I mentioned... was materialized in Karbala, right?
Actualized and realized and personified
manifestation of that over there. But Hazrat Zainab salamu alayhi, Imam Hussein alayhi salam, was telling her to count.
Right? Oh yes, that's a beautiful one. Tell me.
Yeah, that just came to my mind. The other one, the original one, is still at the end, right? And he tells her, say wahid. She says wahid one. Mm-hmm. And he says, say ithnan. And that's when Hazrat Zainab salamu alayha says, ba'd al wahid la ithnan. Once there's one, there's no two, right? How old was she? Three? Years old?
Genius.
Isn't that mind-blowing? And then she asked Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, do you love us? Imam Ali alayhi salam says, Auladuna akbaduna. Our children are... Right, this is
it makes sense in Arabic.
Yeah, like our children are, if I try to make sense, they're a part of us. They're a part of our body and our soul, right? Mm. That's when she, Zainab salam alayha, asks, do you love Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? Imam says, of course I love Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And this is where she says, how can you have two loves in one heart? Wow. Of course, she's Imam Ali alayhi salam's daughter. That
thorough analysis, you know, it just runs in her blood. Now I'm curious as to what was Amir al-Mu'mini's answer.
I love you because... of the love that I have for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Allah, there we go.
You know? And it's not something that's
very light. You know, I love Allah and I love you too because I love him. No, he said, "Auladuna akbaduna," you're a part of me. You are like my existence.
You're
right?
A crucial part of my existence because liver, no one can live without their liver. We need to understand that. Mm. That's the analogy.
Yeah.
And I feel like, you know, the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam, because they are the manifestation of Allah's rahmah, they mirror Allah's mercy. They don't only have that love toward their children, which are a part of their existence.
They certainly do not. I'm going to interrupt you again.
Is that what you're getting paid to do?
I sort of am. One of the scholars was telling us in his speech that they went to Sayyid As-Sistani in Iraq, and he was giving them a piece of advice, and he said this to them. And imagine, this is just a person who was born just like me and you, right? Normally,
the person asking the question.
No, Sayyid As-Sistani.
Not born like you and me.
No, he was born like just another person, without the fact that he's a Sayyid. He was born like, not like me, but then now he's reached a certain level, right? And this is him saying this. And let alone, you said Imam Ali alayhi salam, he has this love for everyone. Sayyid As-Sistani said this to the people as an advice. He said, whatever you do for your children, right, from the very beginning, once in your life, do this for someone else's child. Every single thing that you do for your own child, it for another person's child. So this thing that's in you, that this is my child and this is someone
breaks.
Else. Yeah, destroy that.
That's all the time we have for today's episode of Youth Station. Wash your hands, wear a mask. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
My love, my life, my days, my nights, my wealth, my prayers are for you. Now I know how it's like to have your precious love in my life. Now I know how it feels to finally be at peace inside. I wish that everybody knew how amazing it feels to love you. I wish that everyone could see how your love has set me free. Set me free and made me strong.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 49 meters, 7300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.